suplex.
Delete.
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 Suplex.
Stop saying that.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client.
Delete.
Brock Lesnar conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
This is episode 450 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, July 17, 2016. I am the Solid Monster. And to show you what was going on 100 episodes ago, episode 350, the title of the podcast was Burn All the Titles and Sing Kumbaya. And Dolph Ziggler was the Intercontinental Champion at the time. He had just lost three straight matches on TV, all while remaining the Intercontinental Champion. Didn't lose the title. And this infuriated me. And now here we are 100 episodes later, and I don't know that I could possibly care less about Dolph Ziggler. So, mission accomplished. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free trial of its service for 30 days. If you log on using our URL, which is audibletrial.com/solomonster, you go through the sign-up process, you can sample the Audible service free for a month. You've got 30 days. You can play around with it, check out what they have to offer. They've got over 180,000 downloadable books, audio books, including a lot of wrestling books. And you can cash in on one of those wrestling books. And the cool thing about it, and I think you're going to like Audible, but even if you don't, for whatever reason, and you decide to cancel your trial before the 30 days are up and not be billed, you get to keep that book. You can read it. You can save it. You can reread it. You can hold it for the rest of your life. It belongs to you no matter what. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. Make sure you punch that in the right way. If you've already taken advantage of it, I thank you. You can pass that link around to friends and family, and they can use it. And you've got to go through the sign-up process. Once you do so, you can cash in on your free audiobook, courtesy of the Solomonster Sounds Off. Also, we have our store up on ProWrestlingTees.com. I want to thank everybody who took advantage of the July 4th sale a couple weeks ago. We still have each and every one of those shirts are up in the store. So if you want to grab one, if you're thinking about joining us for our SummerSlam meetup in Brooklyn coming up on August 21st, maybe you want to wear a Sound Off shirt to that. Now is the time to order. It may take a few weeks for you to get the shirt. So ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. There is over two dozen shirts to choose from, including a Sound Off Girl shirt, which was a hotly requested one by a lot of female listeners. There is a Sound Off Girl shirt up in the store. And I want to give another shout out to Mia, who has a great video up on YouTube of her unboxing her Sound Off Girl shirt. So definitely check that out. And also I want to say thank you to people who made a PayPal donation, which is the most direct way to show your support for this podcast. If you go on our website, thesolomonster.com, you'll see a PayPal donate button on the right-hand side. That is always there. And so anytime you want to, no matter what day of the week or time of day it may be, you click on that button and you can sign in. You can make a donation of any amount. $10 or more will get you a shout-out and a wrestling nickname here on the show. I want to say thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Chuck Lunatic Lentz, Hot Stuff Hector Pena, Misfit Miguel Mendoza, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, All Action Reginald Davis II, Pull No Punches, Alan Ragasa, Luck Is for Losers, Lance Flint, Cheryl Oh So Good, Left Hook, Luke Hyams, Edwin Pretty Boy Palenzuela, Soldier of Fortune, Umer Khan, Switchblade, Peter Cox, and the Pittsburgh Pitbull, Robert Ibeck. I want to say thank you for the kind note to Robert. I very much appreciate it. The Chosen Son, Andre Smith. The California Kid, Gabriel Solis. Nemesis, Nathan Moyers. And last but not least, the Windy City War Machine, Metaphor Fox. Thank you to everybody who donated this week. It means a lot to me when you do so. If you haven't checked out any of the videos in the new Sound Off Gamer series on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/thesolomonster, there are two videos up, the initial one, and there was a brief one that went up last weekend. if you missed that. I have now been handily defeated by the Five Knuckle Shuffle and a glitched out Samoa Joe. This is quite the start to my 2K16 career. So you can hop on the YouTube channel, check out those videos. There will be more that go up. I hope to get another one up sometime over the next week. Justin Santiago, I want to give Justin a shout out here. Very talented individual. He has a Solemn Monster creation. He has created a character for me with the whole Let Me School You Son shirt and everything. I am in far better physical stature here in this game than I am here in real life. I'm a lot leaner here in the game. But apparently you can pick me if you want to. I don't know why you would want to, but you can play as me. I guess if you go into the community creation sections and type in Solemn Monster or The Solemn Monster, it should come up. You'll see me wearing that shirt. Maybe I'll play as myself the next time I play. I just think that might go horribly wrong. But if you wanted to play as the Solemn Monster, now you can. So you can thank Justin for that. I am going to be doing a mock draft. This is draft day here on the Sound Off. I'm going to give my opinions, what my Raw and SmackDown rosters would look like here. We're only a couple days away now from the draft as I record this. Who I would choose as the GMs. We'll get to all that once I am through the Raw review. But first, we've got some news to talk about. It appears that Brock Lesnar may have been pissing hot in the lead-up to UFC 200. The story broke on Friday that USADA, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, has informed Brock Lesnar of a potential anti-doping violation from a sample taken from him back on June 28th. The statement on the UFC website says that a full and fair legal review process is afforded to all athletes before any sanctions are imposed. Brock's only statement so far through the Associated Press was, "We'll get to the bottom of this." That's all he has said. And if he tested positive for a banned substance from, a test on June 28th, I don't know why the hell he was allowed to fight in the first place, given that the fight wasn't until July 9. I don't know why it would take so long to get, I can understand them getting the initial results back and then wanting to confirm. But if you get initial results back that say so-and-so is tested positive for a banned substance, I mean, look what happened with John Jones. And even that took a long time. I think it was weeks from the moment he was tested to the time those results came back, and they pulled him from the fight. Now, had they pulled Brock Lesnar from his fight after pulling John Jones from his, I mean, this would have been a complete disaster for UFC. As it is, they probably still did their million and a half buys on pay-per-view or whatever it was. But you pull John Jones from the show and then pull Brock Lesnar from the show. No offense to the other fighters on the show. I mean, there were other, good fights on the card, but that pay-per-view is in the dumps at that point. Now, I'm not saying that UFC knew and they there's a cover-up or anything like that, but they're very fortunate that these results took so long to come back. I just don't understand why it takes so long. I just find that completely ridiculous. Now, if it is confirmed that he failed, he could be suspended for up to 2 years. It puts WWE in a really tough spot. First of all, this is not the headache that they needed. And coming out of the UFC show, it was all about Brock. He's a two-sport guy, and he went back after 5 years, and he beat this guy, and he's on top of the world. And that narrative now, and of course, they didn't say anything about Brock fighting in UFC on TV until after he won, because they probably were worried he was going to get his ass kicked, I guess. And so the next night on Raw, they wouldn't shut up about it, and they had highlights, as they should have. Now they're promoting the fact they had UFC 200 highlights and everything, and it's a great way to kind of begin the promotion for his match with Randy Orton at SummerSlam. Now, all of a sudden, it just puts them in a really tough spot, because you're not going to go on TV and want to be talking up what a great fighter Brock Lesnar is if the only... news that he's involved with now has to do with PEDs. That's not something that, WWE wants to stay as far away from that as possible. So what do they do? How do they handle this now? But it puts them in a tough spot because he's got the match coming up with Orton, which is one of the main events at SummerSlam. He's on the cover of their new video game that's coming out in a few months. But to me, where it gets real interesting, and I posed this question on Twitter literally right after the news came out, before anybody else even asked this question, as best as I could tell. And I was only half being sarcastic when I said it. I said, you know, WWE fired Billy Gunn as a trainer at NXT for failing a non-WWE drug test last year before a powerlifting competition. Apparently, he didn't tell them about the competition. They knew nothing about it. They didn't even know that he had failed. And so once all of this came out, they fired him. And let me just say, I'm not trying to compare Billy Gunn as a trainer, no less, not even as a wrestler. He was a trainer for NXT. I'm not trying to compare Billy Gunn directly to Brock Lesnar and say that, you know, all things are equal here, because they're not. They're not. Even if Billy Gunn was still wrestling, there's virtually no comparison between Brock Lesnar and Billy Gunn as far as them being on the same level. I understand that. I'm not stupid. I'm not trying to say that. What I'm saying is, Billy Gunn was working for WWE, and I would imagine the reason they were quick to get rid of him was he was working with younger guys and developmental, and it just sets a bad example if this trainer who's supposed to be teaching you the way things are supposed to be, it comes out that this guy is taking performance-enhancing drugs. I can understand them wanting to distance themselves and to distance him from all of the kids they have at NXT. I get that. But they still fired him for violating a drug policy that was not their own, for failing a test that they themselves did not administer. And so the question is, will WWE hold Brock Lesnar? Well, not even hold Brock Lesnar, will they hold themselves to the same standard if it is confirmed that Brock did fail a drug test? Now, when I said that, people, of course, were laughing, and I should have clarified. I wasn't asking should they fire him, because that's just stupid. Of course they shouldn't, and they won't. It was more in terms of suspending him, punishing him in some way, not firing him like they did Billy Gunn, but punishing him. Let's say suspending him for 30 days. Would they do that? Even though this wasn't a WWE wellness policy failure. I think it's a question worth asking. Because once they did that with Billy Gunn, my point is this, they established a precedent now for these things. Once you do it the first time, you know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. Once you've set this precedent, how do you apply it to one person in one circumstance and not to another person, no matter how, you know, big of a star they may be? Yeah, that's all I was asking. If they were to suspend Brock tomorrow, his 30 days would be up before SummerSlam. You just went through the same thing with Roman Reigns, which is also why it's just horrible timing for WWE to have two of their biggest names in the news for drug violations. So you just went through the same thing with Roman Reigns, and they are allowing him to stay in the main event at Battleground, which, by the way, I advocated keeping him in that match when a lot of other people wanted this guy's head on a stick. So I'm trying to stay consistent here, because I don't feel any differently about Brock, really, than I did in that situation about Roman. You know, with Roman, I came on here and I said, look, it's the guy's first violation, as far as we know, right? It's the guy's first violation. He made a mistake. People make mistakes. Let him serve out his 30 days. Between that and the shame of it all, and they're humiliating this guy on TV, although now they're trying to turn it into some kind of redemption storyline here. But, you know, between all of that stuff, he paid his penance, he'll come back in 30 days, and he'll move on. There's no need to drag this out and suspend him for 35 days, 40 days. You know, the first violation is a 30-day suspension. Now, I don't think Roman should be winning the title in his first match back, but I had no problem keeping him in that match at Battleground, and I'm holding Brock to the same standard as Roman Reigns. I would be fine with them suspending him for 30 days. You know, and I'm assuming that's his first WWE. It would be his first WWE violation if they honored it, even though it wasn't a WWE test. But if they honored it, that would be, as far as anybody knows, his first suspension. That's 30 days. Not 31, not 32, it's 30 days. Now, the difference, of course, is that Brock is never on TV. He doesn't work house shows. And I don't know that suspensions affect your merchandise income. He's probably still getting that money. So suspending him for 30 days in the build to SummerSlam hurts WWE a hell of a lot more than it hurts Brock Lesnar. But it's still making a statement. I just don't see how they can do nothing. Doing nothing would be worse. but I would not take him out of the match with Randy Orton at SummerSlam. The fact is, we don't know what happened here, but we should know more very soon, possibly even by the time many of you listen to this podcast. I did hear about the report. There was a report going around yesterday online that he failed, not for a PED, but for some asthma medication that he was taking that he didn't disclose. That just smells like bullshit to me. I don't see that being reported by anybody credible, so I don't buy it. I guess we'll find out soon enough. And frankly, even if that is what happened here, you know, look, I guess it's better than finding out this guy was, you know, injecting himself with things that he shouldn't have been doing. But at the same time, rules are rules, and you're supposed to disclose that kind of stuff. But again, I don't know that I buy that necessarily. But the thing is, unlike Roman Reigns, who failed in WWE, will never ever tell us what he failed for because they don't disclose that information. In this case, with Brock, we're going to find out what it was. It's just a matter of time. It's going to come out. And who knows? You know, maybe there was a mistake made along the way. I doubt it. But it's happened before. But I find it very suspicious that, you know, he was tested apparently 6 or 7 times in the lead-up to this fight, and he apparently passed every single one of those tests except the one they administered on June 28th. He passed all the other ones. Doesn't really make sense. So let's just wait and see how this thing plays out. And you know what? Hey, if nothing else, clearly what this means is that his win over The Undertaker at WrestleMania is now nullified, and the streak is still intact. So there you go. Now, for his part, Mark Hunt, who was the unlucky recipient of many, many a blow from Brock at UFC 200, Brock pounded his face into hamburger meat. He's pretty pissed off about the entire thing, and rightfully so. He has every right to be. He said, this is a quote from him. He said, "Brock made millions for this fight, more than anyone ever. I want to know what they're going to do to him now. When you don't make weight, they give 20% of your purse to the other fighter. If you get caught cheating, you should lose all of it. I've told Dana White that I want half of Brock's purse. This is the third time I've had to fight a cheater in my career. The other two times I didn't ask for compensation, but this is the third time, and I'm sick of them getting away with cheating. I've told Dana that I want a release from the UFC if they do not sort this out." All I can say is good luck with that. But I understand the guy's frustration. He has every right to be angry if it comes back that Brock fought dirty. So we'll see. We'll see how that shakes out. Let's talk about Raw. Raw from this past week was live from Detroit, Michigan. Raw Instapoll, almost 1,900 of you voted, 47% thumbs up, 53% thumbs down. This was Vince McMahon's big return. He showed up. He said that tonight he would be selecting two COOs, one for Raw, one for SmackDown. Then he quickly changed his mind and said that since this is a new era, we're going to call them commissioners. Someone should inform him that it's such a new era that WWE had commissioners 20 years ago. Apparently he forgot about that. Seth Rollins interviewed Roman Reigns on this show, which was really, it was just Rollins asking a bunch of questions and Reigns responding in different spliced in clips from other interviews. He was still wearing the WWE title. I mean, it was comical, but not comical enough. I didn't really laugh out loud during this segment. It's the same thing they did with Kurt Angle and The Rock 15, 16 years ago, whatever it was. And that was much funnier than this. Dean Ambrose came out to confront Seth Rollins, and I have to say, I thought he cut his best promo since coming to WWE. This was really good. He even told Seth that he could have a championship match right now, one-on-one, if he wanted. Seth backed down, but they have signed the match tomorrow night on Raw, 6 days before Battleground. We're going to get a championship match between Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose on Raw on the eve of the draft. And I'll tell you something right now. I think, you know, we'll see. I mean, maybe they'll do some kind of a DQ or a fuck finish or something, but I'm thinking Seth Rollins is winning the championship on the show. I think Seth Rollins is winning the WWE title. I think he's going into Battleground defending against Reigns and Ambrose, and I think Dean Ambrose is going to get drafted to SmackDown. That's how I see this whole thing playing out. John Cena, who we were told by AJ Styles earlier in the show was not supposed to be there because he was on the West Coast at rehearsals all day for the ESPY Awards, which he hosted on Wednesday night. Cena, of course, ended up being there on Raw after all. He came to the aid of Enzo and Big Cass, did so to chants of Cena. Lots of Cena chants. First time in a long time I can remember John Cena coming out and getting all cheers. Kaz and Enzo are so over right now, they have turned John Cena babyface. They've done the impossible. And by the way, I thought Cena did a good job at the ESPYs from what I saw. I watched the opening monologue, and that was really it. But from what I saw, I thought he did good. I mean, some of his jokes fell flat, but he's done plenty of promos on Raw, so he should be used to it by now. The best part of the ESPYs is nothing that happened on TV. The best part of the ESPYs was BuzzFeed posting a photo from the red carpet before the show of Ric Flair. Ric Flair was there with Charlotte, and they had a photo of Flair. Charlotte had the women's title on her shoulder, and underneath the photo is a caption that reads, "Ric Flair and guest." I just thought that was great. I thought that was so great. The fight. I want to talk about the fight between the Wyatt family and the New Day at the Wyatt family compound. This was so... I mean, I said this last week, and I know some people say, well, you know, just because things are similar doesn't mean that it's an exact copy of something. This was so clearly a play off the Final Deletion. And I don't care if it was recorded after the Final Deletion aired or if it was recorded before the Final Deletion aired with knowledge of what TNA was doing, because everyone's aware of what everybody else is doing in wrestling. That's just how it is. This was so clearly a play off the Final Deletion. They should have just invited Broken Matt and his dilapidated boat to make a cameo. That's what they should have done. That being said, I didn't hate this. I thought this was enjoyable. The only thing about it that bothered me... Well, I mean, there were two things. But the main thing about it that bothered me was the way it was shot. It was kind of difficult to follow, to be honest with you, the way it was shot. But you know what? A lot of these types of scenes in horror movies, which is what this was meant to be. I mean, this was shot like a scene that you would find in a horror movie. And a lot of the scenes in those movies are shot the same way. And I'm not a fan of that either, to be honest with you. But other than that, I thought this was really well done. It felt like this was the finale of a sequel to The Hills Have Eyes or something. They never actually went inside any sort of compound. They brawled outside. They were on top of cars. They were rolling around in the mud. They were in the woods, and Woods himself, Woods in the woods. He was hiding behind a tree at one point, and Bray Wyatt tried to hit him with an axe. New Day got their asses kicked, but they recovered, and now there's a standoff between them, and all of a sudden, all these kids in sheep masks emerge from the woods, and the New Day retreats. It was different. It was different. I cannot fault them for trying something different. I enjoyed it. But the other thing, the only other criticism I had, and it's not so much of the segment itself, I would have preferred this to be the actual match. I assume they're going to have a regular match next Sunday at Battleground, and that'll be fine. But I would have rather that this be the match on the pay-per-view, and they could do what they've done plenty of times before. They did it with the Hollywood Backlot Brawl with Piper and Goldust at WrestleMania, where they taped it the day before. They did the Undertaker Mankind Boiler Room Brawl from SummerSlam. That was taped the day before. The Dungeon match with Shamrock and Owen Hart, I'm sure that was taped either the day before or a week in advance or whatever. So they could have done the same thing here. They could have taped it in advance, which, I mean, they would have had to, and just air this on the pay-per-view and maybe actually go inside a compound. Again, if you're going to do silly stuff like this, go all the way with it. Make it like something out of a fucking horror movie where you have a little bit of dramatic music in the background and you see them, they're in this darkened compound, they're holding a fucking lantern or a candle so they could see in front of them, and you're turning corners into rooms and you don't know where you're going, and, you know, I think that could be kind of fun. You see a rocking chair, right? You've seen that in movies before where there's a rocking chair, someone's sitting in the chair with their back turned, you don't know... You're going to spin the chair around, you're going to walk around, and you don't know what you're going to see, if it's going to be a dead body or what. Could have been Sister Abigail sitting in the chair. So they could have done a little bit more with this, instead of just having it as a segment on Raw. Darren Young finally re-debuted. He had Bob Backlund in his corner. He re-debuted in a Battle Royal. He was one of 17 bodies in the ring for a Battle Royal to determine a new number one contender for The Miz's Intercontinental Championship. All I wanted to see was Crazy Bob. And again, it feels like 5 years of the same vignettes that we've been seeing with these two over and over and over again. And at first I was so excited because Bob Backlund is out of his mind and he's very entertaining and I'm a big Mr. Backlund fan. And it just got to a point where these segments got so repetitive and so boring and it became so obvious that all they did was they put these guys in a studio for one day and they taped 18 different segments to air over the course of however many months. And I just thought that was so lazy because the comedic potential was there to do segments and skits on the street or in a gym or here and there with both of them instead of doing a stupid split screen with them in the same studio. That was my only criticism of it, and I just got sick of it. But now that we're actually getting Bob Backlund on TV and he's in his corner and in the flesh and they're doing something different, now I can appreciate it. I can appreciate the greatness of Bob Backlund. And Backlund was actually kind of subdued. He wasn't really the focus of this because it was a battle royal. It's hard to put the focus on Bob Backlund when you've got 17 guys wrestling in the ring. But this was designed to get Darren Young over right out of the gate. And before I even go forward, you have to check out, if you didn't see it, because I don't know why this didn't air on TV, you've got to check out their post-match segment on WWE's YouTube channel when the match was over. It's amazing. That's the Bob Backlund that I've been waiting to see. But it came down to Darren Young, Apollo Crews, and Baron Corbin. Corbin and Crews eliminated each other, which left Darren Young all by himself. So he won the Battle Royal really just by doing nothing. He was just kind of sitting there, and he looked as shocked as anybody to win. But I thought it was well done. The people cheered at the end. They were chanting Darren Young's name. I've never heard them do that before. So he gets the win. He's going to get the title match now at Battleground. And when it was over, Bob Backlund got in the ring. He lifted up Darren Young. Now, Darren Young is not a small man. And Bob Backlund is 67 years old. And he picked up Darren Young like he was nothing, and he was carrying him around the ring. He was doing the same thing in that backstage skit that you'll see on YouTube. Okay, when they walked in, he's picking up Darren Young, and Darren Young has to tell him to put him down. For a guy who's 67, I'll tell you something, that's pretty impressive. That is very impressive. And I saw the video also on Twitter of Darren Young was filming Bob Backlund going down an escalator, just holding himself up with nothing but his core strength and his midsection. I can tell you right now, I am half of Bob's age. Am I half? Yeah, I'm just about half of Bob's age. And I couldn't do that. If you gave me an extra two arms, I don't think I could do that. So that's very impressive. After beating Sheamus clean on SmackDown and challenging Rusev to a United States Championship match, how did they follow that up for Zack Ryder? Right, this is the biggest push up that Zack Ryder has gotten in his entire career, if you think about it. This guy goes to WrestleMania, he wins the ladder match to become the new Intercontinental Champion, and then loses it the next night. But now he's beating Sheamus. Just the fact that he got a clean pinfall win with an elbow drop on Sheamus, who's still, even though he's been de-pushed and de-emphasized, I mean, Sheamus is still, in my opinion, one of the more protected guys on that roster. That bro kick is one of the most protected finishes outside of the pedigree. And look at all the wins that he's gotten over guys like Ziggler. And so just the fact that Zack Ryder would be given a clean win over him is pretty impressive. And then he's challenging the champion. So how did they follow that up? Well, they followed that up by having Sheamus lay him out backstage, challenge him to a match, and then beat him clean in 2 minutes with a bro kick. And then, just to make it even better, Rusev came out and he accepted Zack Ryder's challenge to a championship match after he got his ass kicked and pinned. Way to get people excited for that one. Good job. Dana Brooke and Sasha Banks was not, in fact, a disaster, as I had feared it might be. Even in the death spot on the show, I thought the crowd was pretty into it. They were pretty into it. They got more into it as it went on because of Sasha. Sasha got the win. On SmackDown, Charlotte and Dana challenged Sasha to find a partner for a tag team match at Battleground. So this would this be the second month in a row then of pay-per-views with the women's champion wrestling in it? I believe it is. I believe this would be the second pay-per-view in a row of the women's champion not defending her title and wrestling in a tag team match. So they've just been doing nothing but killing time to get to the Sasha feud. So they laid down the gauntlet. They told Sasha to go find a partner. Clearly, this would be a great spot to debut Bayley. I'm sure she's the first name that popped into everyone's heads. Even if she is wrestling Asuka, now I'm not giving away any spoilers here, but I'm assuming that the Women's Championship match at the next NXT TakeOver show in Brooklyn is going to be Asuka and Bayley. I suspect that Bayley is not getting that belt back. And so you could debut her now and still have her wrestle on that NXT show. That's fine. Again, Kevin Owens, when he came in, he was the NXT champion. He didn't lose the NXT title for almost 2 months. So he was on Raw and SmackDown and NXT. He was all over the place. Remember, at one point when Kevin Owens was in NXT, he had about five or six different feuds going. He was feuding with Sami Zayn, and he was feuding with John Cena, and he had a little thing going with Finn Balor and a couple of other people. He had a little mini feud going, I think, with Alex Riley. I mean, he had his tentacles in everything. So you can absolutely debut Bayley in this spot if you want to. Now, I like my idea that I pitched months ago of waiting until the night after SummerSlam, because they're going to be in Brooklyn three straight shows. They'll be in Brooklyn for Raw the next night, and you have her debut there and confront Sasha. Assuming Sasha wins the belt the night before, she can come out in Brooklyn. It's a year after their TakeOver match. They have a little face-to-face in the ring, and that could kind of lead to the eventual match between them at WrestleMania in Orlando next year. But, you know, I wouldn't object to Bayley coming out maybe as a surprise at the pay-per-view. Although, I don't know how many of you have been following these Facebook Live videos that Sasha's been posting. She's been answering fan questions on Facebook. I saw the link. Ironically, it's Facebook. I saw the link on Twitter. But in these videos, she is making it very, very clear, because she's getting tons of tweets about, pick Bayley. Pick Bayley as your partner. And she's making it very clear, I do not want Bayley to be my partner. She's still playing up the fact that she doesn't like her. She doesn't even want Bayley on the roster. She doesn't want Bayley to be called up, she says. Now, coincidentally, in one of those videos that I saw, she talked about how Bayley steals all of her friends, like Nakamura and Kana. Kana being Asuka. And Kota Ibushi. And she admits that she loves Asians, especially Asian men. So, Mish, if you're listening, you have a shot, brother. Make it happen. But what you could do, if Sasha's still playing it up that she hates Bayley, I don't like her, I don't want her as my partner, what you could do, you could have Sasha, let's say on Monday, come out and say, you know what, I don't need a partner. I'm the boss. I don't need a partner. I'll wrestle both of you by myself at the pay-per-view. And then the next night on SmackDown during the draft, Bayley gets drafted, let's say to SmackDown or whatever, because I would suspect Sasha will end up on SmackDown, and in my draft that I'm going to do here in a second, I put her on SmackDown. So let's say Bayley gets drafted to SmackDown, and the SmackDown GM says, well, whether you like it or not, Sasha, you need a partner. And at Battleground, Bayley is going to be your partner. So they do the whole reluctant partners deal, and they win. And then at SummerSlam, since the whole Paige VanZant thing fell through, they were going to do something with Paige VanZant at SummerSlam. And that was another idea that I pitched. I pitched the idea that you have Paige VanZant be in Sasha's corner so she could counter Dana Brooke. Very similar to what they did at SummerSlam, if you think, and I got Scott Hall on my brain because I just watched his DVD. But if you think back to SummerSlam in 1994, okay, over 20 years ago, they did an intercontinental title match between Diesel and Razor Ramon, and Shawn Michaels was in Diesel's corner. And so to counteract Shawn Michaels, they got a local Chicago sports hero from the NFL, Walter Payton, who has since passed away. They got Walter Payton to be in Razor Ramon's corner. And when Shawn would try to get involved, I think he might have punched Shawn in the face at one point, or he pulled him out of the ring. It would be the same thing if you had Paige VanZant, who has since said that she will not be at SummerSlam, but she wants to work with WWE at some point. But my whole idea was, if she's going to be there, you put her in Sasha's corner. And if Dana tries to get involved, she lays out Dana, Sasha wins the belt, and you get that great visual at the end of Paige VanZant holding up Sasha Banks' arm with the Women's Championship. So my point in bringing this up is that Paige VanZant is out of the picture. What you could do, after they tag up at Battleground, Bayley doesn't have to wrestle at SummerSlam. You could do Sasha one-on-one against Charlotte with Dana in Charlotte's corner, and Bayley lobbies and lobbies and lobbies to be in Sasha's corner, even though Sasha doesn't want to have anything to do with her. It's kind of like the whole Remember the whole Steve Austin Mankind thing in 97? Mankind would... I forgot what the storyline was, but I guess Austin was up against the Hart Foundation, and he needed a partner. He was going to wrestle, I think, Owen and Bulldog for the tag team belts. And Mankind would come out every single week, and he had a sign around his neck that said, "Pick me, Steve. Pick me, Steve." It was the funniest thing. And Austin wanted nothing to do with him. He did not want Mankind to be his partner. And in fact, Mankind was not his partner. It turned out to be Dude Love. Dude Love came out to be Austin's partner. So I'm thinking along those lines here with Sasha and Bayley. I see kind of an Austin Foley dynamic developing here. And you have Bayley at SummerSlam in Sasha's corner. I mean, Bayley's going to be wrestling at that weekend anyway in that building. She'll be probably wrestling Asuka, I assume, the night before. So she can have her match with Asuka in the Barclays Center. And then the next night, she doesn't have to wrestle. She can be in Sasha's corner. So I think the whole thing can work out very well. You've got a couple of different ways you can go with the whole Bayley thing, if it's her. I think at this point, I'd be kind of disappointed if it's anyone but her. And finally, it was time for the McMahon family circle jerk. Vince called out Shane and Stephanie, had them plead their case as to why they felt they deserved to be the commissioners of Raw and SmackDown. They each made their case. Vince admitted that he was disappointed neither one of them had slit the other's throat, so he will not be winning any Father of the Year awards. Vince McMahon is not Titus O'Neil. He suspends people like Titus O'Neil. He ends up making Shane the head of SmackDown and Stephanie the head of Raw. Very predictable ending. But they are going with the idea that I pitched, and I'm so happy they're doing this, which is don't make them the GMs, whatever you do. Shane and Stephanie making all the decisions and being the de facto authority figures for Raw and SmackDown at this point, it's so predictable. And so what they're doing is, my whole thing was, you can have Shane and Stephanie oversee the GMs of Raw and SmackDown. And that's exactly what they're doing. They are the commissioners, and they will each appoint their own general manager to make, I guess, the day-to-day booking decisions and the matches and such on Raw and SmackDown. And the drawback of this, even though that is the best case scenario idea that I pitched, what it does mean is you now have two authority figures per show, which is probably two more than they need, at least one more than they need in reality. But you've got two authority figures now for each show. You throw in Vince McMahon, that makes five. Five authority figures on this show, which is completely ridiculous. And that doesn't even count William Regal on NXT, which makes six, but I don't mind Regal at all. William Regal, the great thing about William Regal, he doesn't even show up every single week. He only shows up when shit's going down. When you hear that music and he comes walking out there with that look on his face, you know that shit is about to go down. And that's what I would love to see from these authority figures. Not, oh God, it's Shane. Oh God, it's Stephanie. When you hear the music, when they pop up on the video screen and they make an announcement, you know that, ooh, they're here for something big. They're here to break some big news. That's the way it used to be. I mean, William Regal is the closest thing to a modern-day Jack Tunney that we have in this company. Only with better hair. So Regal, I don't mind. I think Regal is perfect where he is on SmackDown. But they kind of booked themselves into a corner where I just think Shane and Stephanie would have been just so blasé in those. And I like Shane. I'm not saying that Shane is, I'm like sick of Shane at this point, but it just would have been so predictable to put them in there and just keep them as the leaders of each show. So now at least they're going to come up with their own, their own employees or whatever underneath them. And hopefully they have some creative names in mind here. The best part of this entire segment, I mean, forget all that nonsense. The best part of the whole thing, actually there were two. After he made the announcement, Vince told them he wants to see some real competition between them. That means even breaking the law, if you have to, just so long as you don't get caught. It's very important to Vince. You can break the law, just don't get caught doing it. Now we know where Snuka got it from. The other best part of this, though, as Stephanie is climbing down the ring steps, she stumbled a little bit. She almost fell over. And she caught herself, so she recovered quickly, but the damage was done by that point. Everybody is laughing at her, and without skipping a beat, Shane McMahon, he makes this the greatest mocking face, like, oh, that's too bad. And everyone's laughing at her. Stephanie looks legitimately pissed. because she's been embarrassed. It's not a position she's used to being in here on this show, being shown up and being embarrassed and being the butt of jokes, right? No one embarrasses the great Stephanie McMahon. Dusty Rhodes once put his hand up, like talked to the hand. He put his hand up in her face once and she slapped it away, and we never saw Dusty Rhodes on Raw again. I don't think. Right? And so she's so pissed and she couldn't do anything about it. She couldn't slap the steps. And you know she wanted to. You know that she would have slapped those steps if she could have. She wanted to slap those steps so bad, but she couldn't. It was so great. So after the show, one of our listeners tweeted me a screenshot, which ended up getting picked up by... this tweet got picked up by a ton of wrestling sites of a write-up. This was either on WWE.com or the WWE app. It was a write-up on Raw that included a headline, "The Yes Movement Takes Over SmackDown Live." And almost immediately, WWE.com folks, they reworded the headline. They went in there and they changed it. And that got a lot of people talking. Shane McMahon the next day went on Twitter. He said, "I have reached an agreement with someone to become the new SmackDown general manager. The contract has been signed." So to me, it definitely looks like the SmackDown GM is going to end up being Daniel Bryan. Mick Foley would be, you know, a dark horse pick if I had to pick a kind of a backup. He was very entertaining as the commissioner all those years ago. Either way, you need a babyface in there, especially if Shane's running the show. It makes no sense for Shane, for example, to pick... I was going to say it makes no sense for Shane to pick Triple H. I take that back. That would be kind of clever if they did that, to drive a wedge between Triple H and Stephanie, between husband and wife. If Shane McMahon picked Triple H to be the SmackDown general manager. But it wouldn't make sense, though, because Triple H would have to agree. He would have to sign the contract. Why would Triple H agree to it? I mean, if it was a case where whoever Shane and Stephanie pick, especially if, let's say, it's someone who's already under contract, they would have no choice. Their hands are tied. They have no choice. Then you can do that. But I guess if the person has to agree, then it makes no sense. But to me, that would be kind of interesting for two reasons. Number one, you drive a wedge between Triple H and Stephanie, because now Stephanie is working against her husband. And number two, it gets Shane and Triple H on the same show. And I've been waiting to see some kind of interaction on camera between Shane and Triple H, and they haven't gotten there yet. They may never do it, because I sense there is some, on some level, there's some kind of legit tension there. There just has to be. But it would totally work if Triple H was kind of against his will, appointed the GM of SmackDown. Now he's got to oppose his wife, and he's got to work with Shane. You can play off some of the real-life stuff there. You know, even if you want to turn it into a storyline, Shane was the heir apparent, and Triple H took it away from him, and now Shane is kind of being passive-aggressive towards him, and he's I don't know. I mean, I think there's some interesting things you could do there, but I still think it's going to end up being Daniel Bryan. You can't go wrong with either one of those guys if you go with Bryan or Mick Foley as the babyface on SmackDown. I already pitched an idea for this weeks ago. You know who I would choose as the SmackDown GM if it were up to me. And if you don't, we may as well get into this right now. It is fantasy draft time here on the Sound Off. These are the picks that I would make, given the circumstances, given how things have already been laid out in storyline and everything, that, you know, you have Stephanie running Raw, you have Shane, the babyface, running SmackDown. Obviously, that influenced my picks for GM. If I had free reign over this entire thing and I could just pick whoever the hell I wanted to, these rosters would look a hell of a lot different than the ones I'm about to lay out here, but I'm trying to keep them at least semi-realistic. I do want to say one thing first. WWE first announced the brand split in late May. It's been almost 2 months since the news broke. And I find it embarrassing for as big of a deal as they're making this thing out to be, as they should. This is a very big deal. I mean, in a lot of ways, they're kind of blowing up their stories. And they're making a major change here. So this is a big deal. Yet they still haven't bothered to explain to any of us what the rules are for this thing. So we don't know, you know, is it Shane and Stephanie making draft picks? Is it going to be the GMs? We don't know. We don't even know for sure if they're splitting the titles again and having two world champions. That, to me, is the biggest embarrassment. That they kind of just leave us hanging and they're waiting until the very last minute. That's kind of a big deal. Now, I'm sure they are. I'm sure we're getting two world champions at the end of all this. But WWE has said nothing about any of this. I find it ridiculous that they haven't explained any of this in advance. In terms of splitting the titles, how do you do it? To me, it's very simple. I think Rollins is going to win the title on Raw. If he does, he stays on Raw. That's the Raw brand title. On SmackDown, you have a tournament over the next few weeks to determine who goes on to the finals at SummerSlam to crown a new champion for the SmackDown brand. And it comes down to John Cena and AJ Styles. That's how I would do it. No handing the belt out of a briefcase to someone like they did 14 years ago. None of that bullshit. They want people to tune into SmackDown. You need a gimmick, a tournament for a new championship. I think that's one way to make the show important and to give it some real purpose over the next several weeks. So that's how I would do it. Now, one of the questions about this draft, and somebody said, I forgot who it was, that The Undertaker was mentioned, that Michael Cole maybe mentioned The Undertaker's name on Raw, that maybe he's part of it. I didn't hear that, but I admit I try to tune out what the announcers say on that show. So I don't know if they've addressed this already or not, but whether they have or not is irrelevant. One of the questions about the draft is, or was, will The Undertaker be part of it? Will he be drafted at all? He may not even know yet if he's wrestling again. I don't give a shit if he is coming back. To me, The Undertaker should not be part of this draft. He wrestles one match a year, maybe two. Brock is not comparable to me because you'll get a few more matches out of Brock Lesnar than you will The Undertaker, plus TVs, which Undertaker rarely does. I don't remember him doing any TV since the whole Lesnar feud. It's a waste of a pick to draft that guy. Because here's the other issue. He's The Undertaker. How do you not draft him at anything but number one or two? It's ridiculous. What, are you going to draft The Undertaker at number six? You know? But again, that goes to what I was saying before. We don't even know. How exactly is this going to work? Because we've seen before, right, where the draft picks are random. Like that random generator comes on the screen with the little music. And then boom, the person's image appears on the screen. Is this random? Are the GMs going to have a list of who they're picking in a certain order? We don't know, because they haven't told us anything. So maybe it's random and they're not doing numbers, but if they are, you know, going back and forth and picking who they want, how do you not pick The Undertaker at number one or number two? It's ridiculous. And The Undertaker should not be picked that high, because there are plenty of other guys on the roster, younger guys, guys that are coming up, who should be in that spot, not The Undertaker. So don't draft him. When he comes back, he can go wherever the hell he goddamn wants, because he's the fucking Undertaker. Why waste a draft pick on this guy? It's like, imagine the Mets drafting 50-something-year-old Darryl Strawberry to the team. It's ridiculous. Or 50-something-year-old Bobby Bonilla. Actually, they probably should draft the fucking guy. They're still paying him on his contract. And they will be for the next 20 years. Not bad for a guy who retired 15 years ago. Collects $1 million paycheck every year. But yeah, my point is, leave The Undertaker out of the draft. He doesn't need to be in there. If he does come back and he wrestles at WrestleMania next year, the lights will go out on Raw or SmackDown, whatever's convenient for him, and he'll come out. You don't even know who he's going to feud with. You can't tell me they already have a match in mind for The Undertaker next year. Maybe John Cena. I could see them wanting to get that match in there before Undertaker calls it quits. But they don't know. They don't know anything. Why do you think they haven't told us about the rules of the draft? That they probably don't even know. By now, I hope they do. But it probably took them this long to figure out what the hell they wanted to do. So, here are the rosters as I have laid them out here. On Raw, I figured the obvious choice for GM, and partially because you want to probably go with a heel figure, and Stephanie, between Shane and Stephanie, Stephanie is clearly the heel. They made that very clear on Raw Monday night. I figure she'll pick Triple H. We haven't seen Triple H on TV since WrestleMania. He has been absent, and I don't really see any good reason why Stephanie would not want to go with her husband as the pick. I mean, if you think of it from a logical sense, it just makes sense that she would want Triple H in there, and she would clearly have his ear, and she would have influence over those decisions. Now, the obvious downside to this is that if Triple H is the Raw GM and Stephanie is the commissioner, for all intents and purposes, the authority is back in power on TV, which is the absolute worst thing that could possibly happen. I would rather, instead of Triple H, who I think is the person it's going to be, but if you said Solomonster, let's say you don't want to pick Triple H then. Who do you want to pick? Let's not go with him. Well, if it were up to me, why not go with his best friend? Why not pick Shawn Michaels as the GM for Raw? Can't pick him for SmackDown, I guess. He's got the Bible study class, right? So Raw's pretty much your only option, I think. But why not go with Shawn Michaels and give us a fan favorite? Throw us a little bit of a curveball. I know they love their heel authority figures, but throw us a little bit of a curve. And I would go with Shawn. But I figure it's Triple H, you know, and Triple H, if he is the Raw GM, I figure he'll draft his boy at number one, which is Seth Rollins. Especially if Rollins wins the championship, and this is one of the reasons why I think Rollins is going to win the title tomorrow night on Raw, is that if he wins the championship, and now you have a draft the next night, and let's say Triple H is the Raw GM, why would Triple H not want to draft the WWE champion to Monday Night Raw? Of course he would. Of course he would. If Dean Ambrose is still the champion, why would Stephanie want Dean Ambrose on her show? All Stephanie does every single week is come out and talk about what a horrible champion Dean Ambrose is. So why the hell would she draft him at number one? But if he loses the title to Seth Rollins, and Rollins already has the relationship with them, makes perfect sense that Rollins would be your number one draft pick. And so I figure he'll be the number one pick for Raw. Number two, I have Roman Reigns, because you know he's going to be high up there on the list. And you got to keep him away from John Cena. So I have Roman Reigns here at number two. I have at number three in my draft here for Raw. First little curveball here. Bobby Roode. Bobby Roode has been making appearances at NXT house shows and live events. I didn't read the spoilers for any of the upcoming tapings, but maybe he's on TV. He hasn't been on NXT television yet in like a recurring role. And even if he has been, who cares? There is no law that says anybody who's going to be on NXT television in the next 4 to 6 weeks cannot be drafted to Raw or SmackDown and still make NXT appearances for a while. So I would pick Bobby Roode. I think Bobby Roode, I'm not going to say top heel, but I've said that Bobby Roode belongs on the main roster. You know, AJ Styles went right to the main roster. Bobby Roode can go right to the main roster. And I think Bobby Roode can be a solid number two, number three heel on that show. So I would draft him at number three. And the higher up you draft him, there's going to be a lot of WWE fans that don't know who Bobby Roode is. I get that. The higher the draft pick, the more important it feels. That's why I put him at number three. Number four, Bray Wyatt. And as I go through the rest of this list here, I was looking at the people I picked for Raw. And I said to myself, man, this is really heel heavy here. You know, Roman's going to come back. He'll still be booed, but he's a babyface, right? So he's still going to be the top babyface. And I'm looking at some of the other people here I'm going to get into that I'm drafting. And I'm like, man, this is pretty light. I will admit, this is pretty light on the babyface side. But my thought with Bray Wyatt is, with the lack of babyfaces that would be on this roster, my plan would be to slowly turn Bray, which is the direction they had started going in before he got hurt again. And the people are totally going to buy into this guy. I still think Bray Wyatt, if he can stay healthy, which is the challenge here, is going to be a huge babyface. Even bigger than Roman Reigns. In terms of bigger than Roman Reigns, I don't mean that necessarily. He'll sell more merch and this and that. I don't know what kind of draw Bray Wyatt would be as champion on top. I don't know. But I'm just talking in terms of fan support, people getting behind him. I think it would be a lot easier for people to get behind Bray Wyatt as this literal cult babyface than it would be to get behind Roman Reigns. And I think draft him to Raw and start going in that direction. And if all works out in the end and they're not turning Roman, you could have Roman and Bray as the top babyfaces on Monday Night Raw. And I think that would work out very well. Number five, I have Charlotte. Number six, I have The New Day. Again, they haven't explained how this is going to work with tag teams. I assume they're talking about splitting them up, so I assume that means that tag teams are going to be drafted individually and not collectively, but they haven't come out and told us this. They haven't told us anything. So if I'm running things here, I'm drafting the New Day as a package. I'm not doing this individual bullshit. But you know what? Even if they did it individually, I would not break up the New Day. I know some people are getting tired of the New Day. The New Day has a lot of gas left in the tank, and they're still very much over. I don't know what TV show these people are watching. I would keep the New Day together. I would draft them collectively at number 6. Number 7, Chris Jericho. Number 8, The Miz. And I only say The Miz. You're probably thinking to yourself, why the fuck would Solomonster draft The Miz in the top 10? Because he's the Intercontinental Champion. And I like to cling to this false hope that these titles still have some shred of value left in them. And I don't see how you cannot draft your U.S. champ or your Intercontinental champ in the top 10. So I'm putting Miz at number 8. I'm putting Sami Zayn at number 9. And at number 10, I'm putting another NXT guy in here. I'm putting Austin Aries at number 10. With the idea that you will put Rude and Aries, maybe not on day 1, but you will put Rude and Aries together as a tag team. You will reunite the Dirty Heels under whatever name you want to give them on Monday Night Raw. So that's my top 10 for Raw, with Triple H as the GM, or Shawn Michaels if they were smart. Let's go to SmackDown. This is what I'm excited about here. The idea that I pitched a few weeks ago is what I would do. I would go with Kurt Angle as the SmackDown general manager, because I like that idea. No offense to Daniel Bryan. I get my fill of him now on the Cruiserweight Classic. I'm glad he's back on TV. No offense to Mick Foley, who I'm sure would be a perfectly fine GM, and I know he's got his Holy Foley reality show coming out on the network, and they can use Foley in the GM spot to promote the reality show, right? There's no bad side to picking Mick Foley for this spot. But I would pick Kurt Angle. And you would have to think in storyline that Shane McMahon, first of all, it would be a great surprise. Okay, even if you guys see it come in like, oh, I think it's going to be Kurt, it's going to be a surprise. And when his music hits, people are going to lose their shit. And in storyline, Shane McMahon should have as much respect for Kurt Angle as anyone, given their famous street fight. They had one of the all-time great classic brawls in WWE history. So you can even, you know, throw that in there as a little bit of history. Why would Shane pick Kurt? Well, because he's got a lot of respect for Kurt. That's why. Now, I did have Brock Lesnar as Kurt Angle's number one draft pick, because, of course, Kurt Angle would draft Brock Lesnar. Why wouldn't he? I had Brock at number one, because especially coming out of UFC 200, you know, Brock's the real deal, and he's got a lot of momentum right now, and he's the biggest star, the biggest legitimate star they have on that roster. How could you not draft Brock Lesnar at number one? And then all this shit happened. And the fact is, you can't have him at number one. You just can't. It just looks bad. So until this stuff is at least cleared up or whatever, and I doubt this is going to be cleared up by Tuesday, you can't have Brock Lesnar as the number one draft pick. So I had to shuffle this around a little bit, but here's what I would do. John Cena is still the face of the company. I don't care what anybody says. Roman Reigns, even before Roman got popped, John Cena is the face of the company. Period. End of story. And I know he's starting to get involved in other things in Hollywood and branch out, and he's not even working a lot of house shows. I saw there was one report that after this weekend, I think, or something, he's working barely any house shows until September. So you could already see John Cena, which is very interesting if you think back to things that John Cena said in the past about The Rock, and yet here's John Cena doing the exact same thing. But until John Cena is really kind of out of the picture and part-time, he's still the face of the company. So to me, I have Brock getting knocked down a little bit here, a couple spots. John Cena would be the number one draft pick. I think Kurt Angle would draft John Cena to SmackDown at number one. I would have him draft AJ Styles, who he has a history with in TNA, although I wouldn't expect them to acknowledge that. But he would draft AJ Styles in number two. And the club also would end up on SmackDown. They would be drafted later. Not in the top 10, but they would be drafted later. And I have Dean Ambrose at number three. This is assuming that Dean Ambrose loses the championship on Raw tomorrow night. I would have Kurt draft him to SmackDown at number three. Because I think you do want to break up these Shield guys. You don't want all three of them on the same show. It's kind of tired. You'll have Rollins and Reigns on Raw. You got to just move Ambrose out of the picture and put him somewhere else. So I have him at number three. I knocked Brock down to number four. I think that's a safe spot for him. I have at number five Finn Balor. I think it's probably the worst kept secret that Finn Balor is on his way up to the main roster. There's literally nothing else for him to do on NXT at this point. And the fact that he has spent as much time as he has, like almost 2 years, I think, on the NXT roster is kind of ridiculous. But they also kept Sami Zayn in NXT for something like 3 years, which is even more ludicrous. So it's time. They need stars. They need new faces with this brand split. It's time. And I think Finn Balor should be on SmackDown because I want Finn Balor to be on the same brand with AJ in the club, because even if you don't do something right away with them, that's the ultimate direction. Whether you put Finn Balor with them as a heel, and now you've got four guys in the club, or if you want Finn Balor to go up against them, I think there's a lot of potential to do something there. So I want him on the same brand with those guys. I have him at number five. I have Randy Orton at number six. Not only because of the Brock match. I mean, if Randy Orton is wrestling Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam, they kind of have to be on the same brand. But also, I see that Orton is programmed post-SummerSlam at some of the house shows with AJ Styles, so it looks like that's the direction they're going in, and so Randy Orton should be drafted to SmackDown. Even though that puts Orton and Cena on the same brand, which is very dangerous. But I have him at number six. Number seven, I have American Alpha. If you've got Kurt Angle as the SmackDown general manager, you know that he's drafting American Alpha. So I think American Alpha goes to SmackDown. I think at number eight, Sasha Banks. Number nine, Kevin Owens. I would put him on SmackDown. And number 10, I have the United States champion, Rusev. Because like I said with The Miz, you've got to have your secondary champions have to at least be drafted in the top 10. So Rusev would round off my list. And I'll throw one more name in here. I would draft Corey Graves to SmackDown, and I would make it a three-man booth, since they have a hard-on for their three-man booths. I don't know why, but they do. If it were up to me, it would be two. But I would have Corey Graves on SmackDown and pair him up with Jerry Lawler and Mauro Ranallo. I think Corey Graves and Mauro Ranallo would make a great team by themselves, but that's what I would do there. So that makes Finn Balor, American Alpha, Bobby Roode, Austin Aries, and Corey Graves. Those are the NXT names that I would have as part of this draft. I would love to throw in Samoa Joe, who belongs in the main roster, and Shinsuke Nakamura, and Bayley, who I think is coming up anyway. But to me, it makes no sense to draft Joe and Nakamura right now, since they're going into that championship match. And you've got enough other names with Balor and those guys. You don't have to call them up right now. Joe and Nakamura, they're going to come up, especially Joe. I mean, the idea that they could do Joe and Brock at some point, to me, is, you know, that's the direction you want to ultimately be going in here. But you don't have to call them up right now. I think you have enough other names here that you don't need to call them up right away. And I think also, NXT is going to be just fine. You know, you can call up all of these guys, and I think NXT will be fine. They've got 32 people in the Cruiserweight Classic, many of which I'm sure are going to end up being offered a contract. So you take who's left on that show, you couple that with a lot of those guys from the tournament, and, you know, they already have Kota Ibushi. Kota Ibushi has signed some kind of contract. I don't know if it's full-time or not, but he signed some kind of a deal with NXT. And believe me, Kota Ibushi will not be the only one. They can afford to bring half a dozen guys over to breathe some new life into these two rosters, because they need it. Now, tag teams. The rumor mill has been swirling that WWE plans to break up some teams in the draft. I don't know why they insist on doing this. It's just to shock people, I guess. They tried that once before with the Dudley Boys, and that didn't work out too well. But they tried it with Miz and Morrison, and it worked out very well. At least for the Miz, worked out very well for him. So, if they are going to break up any tag teams, here is what I would do. First of all, these are all the teams on the main roster that I could come up with. I made a list. So I'm pretty sure I covered all of them. I've got New Day, The Club, Kaz and Enzo, The Usos, The Wyatt Family, The Lucha Dragons, The Vaudevillains, The Golden Truth, The Shining Stars, The Ascension, and The Social Outcasts. I think that is the complete tag team roster as it is today. That's a lot of teams. A lot of shitty teams, too. But that's a lot of teams. If they want to split two or three of them, I think that's fine. Provided they bring up a couple of new ones from NXT. Because that, to me, you know, it reads like a really long list. Wow, that's a lot of tag teams. But guess what? When you split that list in half, it's not so big anymore. So if they call up American Alpha, and if they do what I suggested, which is you call up Bobby Roode and Austin Aries, and ultimately you put them back together as a tag team again, then I think that's fine. I think they'll be fine. So, who would I split? I would split up the Dudley Boys. I just said, it didn't work out very well in 2002 when they broke those two guys up. But that was 14 years ago. Times have changed. The Dudleys right now, they're just two bodies on the roster. They're not doing anything with them. And as stupid as it was for them to do it all those years ago, I think it's a lot smarter for them to do it now. And if they do split them up, I think that's it for D-Von. I don't see a role for D-Von on the show as a single. I mean, they have far too much talent. They don't need D-Von, especially as a single. I think if they split them up, that's it for D-Von. It's Bubba who I think has potential, however old he is, 40 or whatever. But, I mean, Bubba, anybody who saw Bully Ray in TNA knows that there's a lot of potential there, I think, for Bully Ray to be a solid heel, like upper mid-card heel, on either one of those rosters. And we really haven't seen that side of Bully, Bubba, whatever, since he came back to WWE. The guy's a great promo. It would breathe new life into him. Like I said, a great heel to have on the roster, a great bully to have on the roster. I saw a clip from Main Event. It was on Twitter. I guess it was this past week. Some giant tag team match that they had. He was in there with one of the Usos. And Bubba is beating this guy down, like, with punch after punch after punch. And every time he would punch him in the head, he would tell him, "This is for WrestleMania." Boom. He goes, "This is for The Rock." And he would punch him in the head. "This is for your 97 cousins." And he would punch him in the head. It was great. I was laughing my ass off. He just needs to be that guy all the time. That's the Bubba Ray that I find entertaining. So I would split them up. The only other team that I would split, because I'm only splitting two. The only other team I would split is this Breezango, whatever the hell they're called. I had answered a mailbag question a few months ago, and I actually advocated against breaking these two up. I said breaking these two up is probably the worst thing that you could do for either one of them, because at least they're getting TV time. Tyler Breeze was not getting any TV time. He was losing all of his matches on whatever shows he actually appeared on. He was never on TV. Fandango, people thought he was fired. All of a sudden, one day, he's back on TV. Holy shit, this guy is still employed. So at the time, I said, don't break him up, because that's the worst thing that you could do. Well, now you've got the draft. And in theory, this would be a great time for Tyler Breeze to go back to being a single. Not that he's going to be in the Main Event mix or anything, or that he should be, but just if ever there was a time for him to go back to being a single and maybe give this guy a good run with the U.S. title or the Intercontinental title and give him some TV time and let him show his chops as a singles guy. That a lot of us who watched NXT, we saw him in those main events on those takeover specials. The guy is fucking awesome. There is absolutely, in my opinion, a role for him on that show as a single. And if you're gonna try it, this is it. Now's the time to do it. You're gonna do the split. You would think that some people, like I said, Becky Lynch, I remember saying that a month ago or whatever. One of the benefits of doing the draft is that someone like Becky Lynch could really benefit. Becky Lynch may end up being a champion if they were gonna split the women's title. Of course, they haven't told us that. They haven't told us a fucking thing. I'm assuming that Charlotte will be the sole women's champion, but who the hell knows? If they do split it off and Becky Lynch ends up on a different brand, Becky Lynch probably get herself a run with the championship. So there are certain people, I think, who could stand to benefit from a draft, and I think Tyler Breeze could be one of those guys. And, you know, and also, I'm not a fan of this team, and I think their remixed music absolutely sucks. It's just terrible. Any excuse to not have to listen to that music anymore? As far as, you know, Fandango goes, well, you know, shit happens. I mean, what can I say? I would not split the Shining Stars. Some people may be wondering, why would you keep the Shining Stars together? Why would I even keep them employed is the better question. But they're talented guys. What I would do, you have a draft. Supposedly WWE's been calling some older guys. And when I hear this, I'm thinking, what guys are they calling? I hear that, and I think they're calling people from the mid to late 2000s, like a Shelton Benjamin or a Carlito or a Chris Masters. Like, that's in my mind what I'm imagining the people they're reaching out to. I would have to think they reached out to Carlito. If Carlito is willing to come over for the right amount of money, I say bring this guy over as quickly as you can and stick him with the Shining Stars, because that is the only way you are going to salvage that act, is by making them a trio. That at least would make them semi-interesting and would give them a shot. So that's what I would do. I would do whatever I could to bring in Carlito for the draft, put him with the Shining Stars, make him a trio, and there you go. And, you know, they can be on TV every week in six-mans, and it would be a hell of a lot better than what they have them doing now. You're certainly not going to keep the Shining Stars employed and split them up. There's absolutely no fucking point to doing that. You know, keep them together and make them a trio. So, I think that covers all the different bases here. I'm looking at these two rosters here that I just laid out. Clearly, I am a SmackDown guy. But, again, I did it that way on purpose because I know they want to make SmackDown as strong as possible. They figure Raw's the flagship. Raw's going to always have their base viewers no matter what. We got to make SmackDown strong again. And I know USA wants them to get SmackDown's numbers up. And you've got to justify the expense of going live every week. And in order to do that, you need to load it up with stars. So SmackDown clearly, based on what I laid out here, SmackDown clearly has the advantage. And plus, also, it's 2 hours. If you end up with a SmackDown roster that looks even remotely like the one that I just laid out, coupled with the fact that it's now live, which live seems to matter to some people, so it's live, it's 2 hours. Look at the announcers. Look at the difference in announce teams on the show. The better question is, why would anybody watch Raw?
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT was a one-match show this week, and what a match it was. Unfortunately, they hyped this thing up like it was going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. I think I would have enjoyed it more had they not gone so overboard with the hype. It's just like every 5 seconds, this is the greatest match of all time. You're going to remember where you were when you saw this match. No, I won't. Finn Balor and Shinsuke Nakamura, though, they had a really, really great 25-minute match. Balor's swan song. They didn't say that, but to me it has to be. There's, like I said, literally nothing left for this guy to do on this show. Joe and Nakamura in Brooklyn is the only main event that really makes sense. Balor worked, he worked almost like a heel, very heelish in this match at parts, just merciless in working over Nakamura's leg. And because I criticized Jason Jordan for the same thing in that 2 out of 3 falls match a week ago against the Revival, I have to bring up Nakamura here. And Nakamura, hey, you know, one of the best wrestlers in the world, one of my favorites, but here he is on the mat in this leg lock, and Balor's kicking his leg and his knee. He is screaming in pain. We have not heard screams like this from Nakamura. And a minute later, he's back up on his feet, not selling a thing. Throwing knees, no less. With the injured leg. Just like nothing ever happened. But, having said that, I still love the match. Nakamura won after a Kinshasa off the ropes. Then he hit a normal standing Kinshasa for the pin. They shook hands after the match. So this was great stuff. I have no complaints about this. Samoa Joe, though, I want to get to Samoa Joe. I'm kind of going in reverse order here, because Samoa Joe opened the show with a promo. First time we've seen Joe since his last title defense, so it's been many weeks. He opened the show with this great fucking promo. He had this one line that I loved. He was talking about Balor and Nakamura and who might be next in line for the title shot against him. And he mentioned how Nakamura is known as the King of Strong Style. And he goes, well, I'm the guy that brought Strong Style to these shores. And I don't know why, I just love that line. It was one of many lines in this promo, but that line in particular stood out to me. This was just awesome. And Rhino came out. He challenged Joe to a match. So next week, it's going to be Joe against Rhino. I don't know. I don't remember if they said if this was going to be a championship match or not. It shouldn't be, because Rhino's done fuck all to earn a title shot. But they're going to wrestle. It'll be American Alpha against the Authors of Pain and Bayley against Nia Jax. So by NXT standards, it's a pretty loaded show next week. The Cruiserweight Classic debut episode aired this past week after NXT. Let me mention this first. Tommaso Ciampa, who has been wrestling part-time for NXT now for a number of months, he's one of the 32 men here in the Cruiserweight Classic. He announced on his Twitter that his last independent date will be for Progress, the Progress promotion, September 25th, against Zack Sabre Jr., ironically also a part of the Cruiserweight Classic. So it would appear that he has signed a full-time NXT deal. So congrats to him. I absolutely love the presentation here of the Cruiserweight Classic. The Full Sail Arena, they try to convert it and make it look as different as possible. The lighting, the colors, the aisleway was different. There was no ramp, which I liked. The mat, I think it had the logo, actually, on the mat, which is something WCW used to do. The ropes, the turnbuckles, everything about it, they tried to make it different than NXT. And I appreciate that, because the show should have its own identity. Mauro Ranallo and Daniel Bryan on commentary, on their first day, they are already the best announced team in WWE. All due respect to Tom Phillips and Corey Graves, who I enjoy. I thought these two guys, it's only been one show, and to me, they're number one. They're tops. Bryan, he was so excited. You know, he was so excited to be there. And I love the cutaways to Corey Graves and the control center. Reminded me of the old control centers they used to do on Superstars and Wrestling Challenge, just with nicer graphics now, obviously. And, of course, Corey Graves has more hair than Mean Gene did. On the graphics thing, one of you emailed me and pointed out that the match graphics on this show were very Street Fighter-esque. And I didn't realize it at first, but you're right. Someone on that production staff is obviously a Street Fighter fan. Because that's exactly what those match graphics look like, right down to the little versus thing in the middle. But I loved the little profile pieces they had on each of the guys. The Tale of the Tape. Tale of the Tape is something they used to do on SmackDown back when Cole and Taz were still calling the show. So the Tale of the Tape thing is nothing new, even to WWE. So I was glad that they brought that back here, because the whole point is they wanted to make this more of a serious sports, you know, competition like presentation. And I thought they succeeded in doing that. It was different than anything WWE has done before. You can see they're going for a mix here of MMA and Ring of Honor, apparently, with the pre-match handshake. I guess you have to adhere to the code of honor here at the Cruiserweight Classic. And after the match, they have the referee holding both guys' hands, and then he raises the winner's arm like you would in an MMA fight. The only thing missing from the whole presentation was Joe Rogan doing post-match interviews. And if Rogan leaves UFC like he says he would, Joe Rogan has said that if UFC was sold, he would be leaving. And now UFC has been sold for $4 billion. I'm just saying, you know, Joe Rogan may be available. Maybe make him an offer. So this was my, I want to bring up my bracket here, because everyone was posting their bracket online for the Cruiserweight Classic, and who do you think is going to win? And I filled out my bracket here. It's up on Twitter and Facebook if you want to see the entire thing. I won't read the whole thing. The point is, all of my picks for the first matches that we saw here on the initial episode were right, and so I'm on the right path. I don't foresee getting the entire thing right, but my final that I have here is probably similar to many of your final matches, which is Kota Ibushi and Zack Sabre Jr. I think that's the biggest match you could do. Maybe they'll throw us a curveball here just to kind of throw us off our guard a little bit. It's very possible, but I think Zack Sabre Jr. and Kota Ibushi is maybe the only match that you could do in this tournament where it comes down to these two guys and you don't really know who's going to win. You know, and that final match is not being taped. It's going to air live, and it could easily go to either one of those two guys. So to me, that's why you do that match. They probably are two of the best guys in the entire tournament anyway. It's not a stretch to think that they would end up there. But I think because those are the two that are probably picked by most people to win, it makes it unpredictable. So in my bracket, that's what I have as the final match. All first-round matches they announced have a 20-minute time limit. Time limits! Jim Ross must love this show. We had Gran Metalik from Mexico, representing Mexico, against Alejandro Saiz, representing Chile. He was the one who had to cut 30 pounds just to make the tournament, which sounds unnecessarily dangerous to have to do for a worked pro wrestling match, but I'm assuming they do the whole weight cut thing, not just to make it kind of look real, but they do it as much to just kind of see who has the commitment to lose weight. I think that probably shows a lot. Someone like Cedric Alexander, who lost a bunch of weight to make weight for this tournament, that probably showed them, hey, you know what, this guy's committed, this guy really wants it. That's probably why they do it. Anyway, Metalik won with the Michinoku driver. This was a good match. I especially liked Daniel Bryan and Mauro Ranallo losing their shit when Alejandro Saiz here did a shooting star press off the apron. He just went nuts. But I thought both guys here looked good. Ho Ho Loon, representing Hong Kong, against Arya Daivari, representing Iran, which, of course, got him heel heat. Daivari refused to shake hands before the match, refusing to adhere to the code of honor, which should be an automatic elimination from this tournament if they really wanted to be serious about this. He was a much better wrestler, I thought, than Ho Ho was. Such a funny name. But Ho Ho, I could see him getting over as a big underdog babyface. He was already getting over as a big underdog babyface here. He was not as good of a wrestler as Daivari was, but the people were getting behind this guy. And I like him. I it was the first time I ever saw him wrestle. I already liked the guy. His facial expressions, he was kind of shocked when he won. He had like a little 1-2-3 kid vibe going on here, although by this point the 1-2-3 kid was a much better wrestler than he was. Daivari missed a splash, and Ho-Ho hit him with a super kick, which my only criticism here is that should have been the finish. But instead he... Now, again, if he had a better move to beat him with, it's like my criticism of Ultima Lucha last week, and there were some people who got on me for that. Why are you criticizing Lucha Underground? So, first of all, you will not find a bigger Lucha Underground fan than me. So that's number one. First of all, shut the hell up on that. And number two, if I see something that bothers me or that I think is nonsense, I'm going to call them out on it. And my big criticism of the Cage Mac match last week was Mac did a frog splash from a very high altitude through a table, and that was not the finish. And the finish they went with 2 minutes later was Cage getting rolled up by a schoolboy because he slipped. So again, in a case like that, why not just make the splash the finish? It was kind of the same thing here. If Ho Ho Loon was going to bust out some amazing move and he was going to beat Daivari with it, it's like, whoa, that was pretty cool. He beat him with a bridging German suplex. So again, I'm not angry about it. I just thought it was very weird. And I thought that, you know, when Daivari missed the splash and he kicked him in the head and knocked him out, that probably should have been the finish. But anyway, if we're supposed to believe that this is a real competition, I guess it's real, right? So anything can happen. So we had Clément Pichot representing France, why did I say that weird, against Cedric Alexander representing the good old US of A. Cedric, he looks in great physical shape. He slimmed down for this thing. Got to make weight. I thought Alexander was the standout here. He won with a back suplex into a double knee backbreaker for the win. He is moving on now to face the winner of this next match, which was the main event on this show. Kota Ibushi, representing Japan, against Sean Maluta, representing American Samoa. And apparently all of the Usos' 97 cousins that Bubba Ray Dudley was yelling about on main event the other day. If Kota Ibushi can just learn English, I'm assuming he knows none, because when they show the interviews here with him, he's speaking all Japanese. If he can learn some English, he would be a massive star in this company. He's already a massive star in a lot of ways, but he would be a massive star inside WWE, like a main roster WWE star. Because he's got a good look, he's very talented. He can work. He could sell. The guy is great. And not for nothing, I got to say, this Sean Maluta guy, I've never seen him before, but he was impressive in this match. Although, there was that one spot where, and they could try all they want to pass it on. Well, he meant to do that. Bullshit. He didn't mean to do that. He nearly killed himself on a flip dive out of the ring. It looked like maybe his foot got caught on the ropes on the way down, and thankfully he survived unharmed. It wasn't quite as reckless as Ahmed Johnson diving out of the ring onto Goldust at the King of the Ring in 1996, but it was kind of in that same corner of the ring, which I think is why it reminded me of Ahmed. So anyway, Ibushi won with the Last Ride Powerbomb, which clearly means that he is headed for a feud with The Undertaker, which should be interesting. No, I'm just kidding. So Ibushi wins, he moves on, and he will face Cedric Alexander in the next round. The matches coming up on the show this Wednesday are Tajiri against Damian Slater, TJ Perkins against Damac, Lince Dorado against Mustafa Ali, and Akira Tozawa against Kenneth Johnson. I believe those are the four matches coming up this Wednesday. So it's only been one show, but you know what? So far, so good. I am enjoying this. I'm enjoying anything different that WWE has to offer. TNA, speaking of different, it's That's probably why I enjoyed the final deletion so much. Moose from TNA debuted on Impact this week. He was helping out another fellow ROH alum, the Miracle Mike Bennett, taking out Eddie Edwards and Bobby Lashley during their main event. Supposedly, he has signed a 2-year deal. WWE was going to sign him. They got wind of a domestic violence situation that he was involved in something like 7 years ago. And so they backed off. I'm not sure that that would have happened were it not for the whole Adam Rose thing and the Jerry Lawler thing still so fresh in people's minds. I think had those things never happened, Moose would probably be heading for the Performance Center in September. But their loss is TNA's gain, at least until his contract is up and then he comes to NXT. I did see the post-final deletion vignettes with Broken Matt at his home. I did watch that. My favorite part was him speaking to the female server in his home, which, by the way, what a fucking house this guy has. But my favorite part, he was speaking to this woman in Spanish, and she tells him, "I don't speak Spanish, I'm Romanian." And he just goes, "Wonderful!" And then he said, "Gracias," because of course. And he just had this giant smile on his face. Broken Matt is like a revelation to me because, again, I haven't really been paying much attention to TNA, and I knew he had kind of, I knew the whole Big Money Matt thing he was doing for a while, and I knew he kind of went a little nutty cuckoo, but I wasn't really paying attention. But this is just amazing. Although I have to say, I did stick around long enough to see his segment with Jeff on Impact in the ring when he called out Jeff. And I like Broken Matt, but to me, Broken Matt in the arena as opposed to Broken Matt in these vignettes is not the same thing. He is far more enjoyable in these skits than he is in the ring on TV. So I enjoyed this. And of course, in that same skit, he asks Vanguard 1, the Vanguard 1 drone, to give him some mood lighting. I have to get me one of those. If you do watch Impact, though, every week, if you are an Impact fan, remember that it begins this week in its new time slot, Thursday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern. They are airing an extended version of the final deletion this Thursday. Got to milk that thing for all it's worth. It's actually smart. You know, it's smart of them to do that. I'm not faulting them at all, but they're going to beat this thing to death until it's got no juice left in it. Lucha Underground. This was week 2. Of Ultima Lucha Dos, which was better than week 1. How can I hate on a show that ends with Dario Cueto beating a guy to death with a Red Bull statue? I can't. I can't hate on that at all. Show opened with a 7-person elimination match to crown a new Gift of the Gods champion. It was Daga, Sinestro de la Muerte, Sexy Star, Mariposa, Marty the Moth, Killshot, and the debuting Nightclaw. Imagine the smile on my face when I saw Nightclaw pin, I think it was Sinestro de la Muerte, with a standing C4. Thank you. You see that, Mundo? You see that? Anyway, no one's going to get that unless they heard my review from a couple of weeks ago, but that made me very happy. Nightclaw, he didn't win this match, even though it was his debut match. He lost here in his debut, but he looked impressive. At one point, he climbed all the way up onto the one of the balconies, the one that Angelico dove off that one time. Actually, I think he dove off it twice. But here, once he got up there, he walked right up to the edge. He turned his back and he did a moonsault onto all of the other wrestlers down below. And I watched that and I thought to myself, you know, it takes an insane amount of trust to pull off a move like that. I'm amazed. I am amazed at the balls that it takes to even attempt a move like that. If I had to do that, I'm telling you right now, I would shit myself. Like right there in front of everyone, just like, boom, there it is. I don't like heights to begin with, so that doesn't help. I can remember the first time I did trapeze. I started climbing the ladder. Okay, so we're outdoors here, and this giant structure, and I start climbing the ladder, and I was doing fine until about halfway up. I decided to look down, and that was the beginning of my downfall. I started to clam up. I started to get all sweaty. It took me like twice as long to climb up the top half of the ladder as it did the bottom half. And when I finally got up there, it was this little tiny platform. It's ridiculous. I had to lay on my belly just to maneuver myself up into a standing position because I was so goddamn terrified of falling off the platform. And there's this Australian kid, younger than me, just no harness or rope or anything, just kind of hanging off the side, waiting for me. He's all like, you know, put your hands out, mate. Come on, mate, put your hands out. Because he wanted to put chalk on my hand, so I guess I could grip the bar. And he looks at my hands and he just goes, wow, your hands are really dry, mate. I don't think you need any chalk. So he hooks me up to the harness. And I don't even know why I'm telling this story. I'm harnessed in now. And he tells me, dangle my toes off the edge of the platform and reach forward to grab the bar. That's what he tells me to do. And in my head, I'm like, are you out of your fucking mind, mate? Are you out of your mind? You want me to lean over this thing? So eventually I do it, because what choice do I have? So I grab the bar, and, you know, I grab it. There's a guy down below, and he's yelling up to me, and he goes, are you doing a bullet drop? Or I forget what the other one was called, but it involves, in midair, it involves you putting your legs, like after you jump, it involves you then maneuvering yourself and putting your legs over the bar so you're hanging by your legs, like a monkey, you're hanging by your legs. And to me, you know, there's a better chance of Vince Russo and Jim Cornette breaking bread together and singing Kumbaya than that ever happening. So I told him, I'll do the bullet drop. And then I realize, what the hell is a bullet drop? I didn't even know what it was. And the guy on top, he explains, you got to grab the bar with your arms and you hop off. It's very important. You need to hop, not jump. I'm like a fucking rabbit. You have to hop off. And then once your body gets horizontal, you let go of the bar and just let your body fall. You kind of fall flat from 30 or 40 feet up, whatever the hell it was. You know... I'm not quite sure how I was expecting to get down, but the idea of going horizontal and just letting go, it seems very counterintuitive. Now, I'm about to shit a brick, goes without saying. I have nowhere to go. I can't climb down. There's no way I can climb down, not without my man card getting revoked. You gotta do it. You gotta do it. That's all there is to it. So I did it. I even went up a second time because I'm a moron. The only person who went up there that day twice and did a bullet drop both times, yours truly. And yet, the hardest part of the whole thing, that entire experience, the hardest part for me as someone who's afraid of heights, it wasn't the drop, right? I say that about roller coasters, because I'll go on roller coasters too, even the ones that scare the shit out of me, because again, I'm a moron. But at least I'm willing to try. And with the roller coaster, when you go on it, it's not so much... when you go down, like even if it's a steep drop and all that and all the loops, and it's not that, it's the ascent, right? Because you're sitting there, it's the anticipation of it. It's going up slow and slow and slow, and that's the most stressful part about the whole thing. Once you get to the top and you finally go down, first of all, it's over in 20 seconds, and it's not a big deal at that point. So it's kind of the same thing here. I think it's the anticipation of it, it's worrying about it instead of just fucking manning up and doing it. That's the worst part of something like that. And my point is that I have an insane amount of respect for what it takes to go up there and to do something like that without even thinking. I mean, this guy went up there. He didn't take 10 seconds to think about what he was going to do. He waited until everybody was in position. He turned his back and off he went. That was it. Like second nature, like he does this every day. And even more so if you're someone who's afraid of heights. Now, I don't know if Nightclaw is afraid of heights. I get the sense that he isn't. But I think of someone like Devon Dudley. Devon Dudley is on record as saying he is deathly afraid of heights. And yet Devon Dudley is one of the things he's most well known for are all those TLC matches. Even the very first one, right? He climbed and I think someone knocked the ladder over or they moved the ladder over and he was up there. He was hanging. And then he had a drop and fall. What must have been going through his head when he did that? And he had a drop, right? He did his own bullet drop. So to me, it takes an insane amount of guts to do something like that. And it just made me think of that story for some reason. Anyway, I have no idea where I left off. It came down to Marty the Moth and Sexy Star. Oh boy, Sexy Star. Well, first of all, there was a very audible chant here of "kick him in the dick." So it's nice to see the Undertaker drop by the temple. Sexy Star's offense here. I have a note. I have a little bullet point here to talk about this, because Sexy Star's offense here was embarrassingly bad. Like, embarrassingly bad. And if I'm going to criticize Eva Marie for moving like she's underwater, then I have to do the same thing here. Everything this woman did here was so deliberate. And it's on a show with so many talented guys. And this is not a male versus female thing, so don't even try to turn it into that. But she is on a show, a male-dominated show, with so many other people who are so freaking talented that they could do backflips in their sleep. Okay, some people wake up and they sleepwalk. Not these guys. These guys wake up in the middle of the night, they sleep flip. Okay, that's how talented a lot of these guys are. And she's in a match with a lot of them. Even in this, forget the show, in this match, she is in there with people who are far more talented than she is. And they're all eliminated, they're all gone, so now it's her and Marty. Or it's Marty and Mariposa, before Mariposa got eliminated. And I'm watching this, and I'm just like, ugh, this is bad. This is awful. This is just awful. And I say that as someone who thought that the No Mas match that she had with Mariposa, that's one of my favorite matches all year. I'm not going to call it the match of the year, but, you know, it's on my list. When I make a list at the end of the year, that one's probably going to be on there. I love that match. It's not a bias that I have against her. Or any of the women. I mean, I'm not a fan of male versus female in Lucha Underground, the intergender stuff. I'm okay with it. Like, it doesn't bother me if let's say it's Sexy Star is in there in a six-person tag, and Ivelisse is on the other team, and they get in there and they work together, and then maybe Ivelisse is in there for 30 seconds or a minute with somebody else, and she does a couple of moves. Like, that doesn't bother me. But it's the whole, we're going to have Ivelisse against Pentagon, or we're going to have Sexy Star against Marty. Like, I just can't get into that stuff. So, but putting that on the side for a second, though, I thought in that match, for the story they told, Sexy Star was awesome, Mariposa was awesome, it was a great story, they brawled all over the place, it wasn't just a straight wrestling match. Here she was doing wrestling moves, and she had a setup for these wrestling moves, and she needed cooperation from both of them to do them, and it just, you know, they have her positioned here on this show, clearly, as one of the top stars. And she won this match. This was a match for the Gift of the Gods Championship. And Sexy Star won. She tapped out Marty the Moth with a cross arm breaker, which makes her the first female to hold a singles title in Lucha Underground. And it also means that she has now earned herself a shot at the title, the Lucha Underground Championship. And I can see where this is going. And I have but one request, which is hard because I know this is a tape show, so it's not like anything's going to change. Whatever it is that they have planned is already set in stone. But I have one thing to say, and that is this. As much as I am a fan of the Monster Matanza, big Matanza fan, I sincerely hope that he drops the title before Sexy Star cashes in her title shot. I don't even want to think about the idea of him losing his champion. And he's been blowing through guys left and right. I mean, he's a monster. He's been beating everybody. Nobody can stop him. I don't even want to entertain the idea of Matanza's reign coming to an end at the hands of Sexy Star. Now, maybe he'll lose the title to Pentagon this week in the Ultima Lucha finale. But I doubt it. But maybe he will. Maybe he'll lose it to Pentagon. And frankly, I'm not sure that that's any better, because we've already seen Pentagon in a singles match, lose to Sexy Star. And I sure as hell don't want to see him lose the title to her. She's not even a wrestler anymore. She's retired. Yeah, she's moved on. She's going to do boxing now. But yes, I do not want to see Matanza losing his championship. I don't even know what the great alternative would be. Right? Because I don't want to see Pentagon lose it to her either. So, I don't know. I mean, maybe Pentagon beats Matanza for it, and then Pentagon loses it to, I don't know, maybe Katrina puts a spell on him And Katrina, because Katrina's a demon, right? She's like a 500-year-old demon or something. So maybe Katrina becomes Lucha Underground champion. Then you could have Sexy Star beat Katrina, and she could become the champion. But otherwise, I just don't want to see it. Anyway, back to the police station, Estación de Policía. Joey Ryan and Cortez Castro are wiring up Mr. Cisco. He's very reluctant to wear a wire because he knows that if he gets caught, he's fucked. And they're telling you, you're not going to get caught. You're not going to get caught. Don't worry about it. You got to do this, though, because if you do, I forgot if they said they would drop the charges against him or if they would reduce the charges against him. So he agrees to do it. And at that point, you realize this is not going to end well for this guy. We had Mil Muertes and King Cuerno in a death match. I do love it when we get pissed off Mil Muertes in these types of matches. He won. Mil Muertes got the win, not before Mil Muertes powerbombed King Cuerno through three different tables outside the ring. And then he hit Cuerno in the head with a crowbar to win the match. He absolutely destroyed King Cuerno in this match, to the point where Cuerno had to be carted out when it was over. And Katrina gave Cuerno the lick of death beforehand, which is still my favorite finish in all of wrestling. So this was great. This was just a great fight, a great brawl. I enjoyed this. I thought this was exactly what it had to be. Keep Mil Muertes looking strong and dominant. And so we have Matt Stryker at the end. He's running down all the matches for next week's finale. And he gets to Pentagon's match with Matanza. And Vampiro all of a sudden got real serious. He grabbed a garbage can. He dumped his pills into it. Oh, took his pills. He threw his pills away. What wrestler does that? So the pills, these pills are supposed to keep him normal. And he throws them away and off he goes. He's going to prepare Pentagon for his big battle with Matanza next week at Ultima Lucha. So the show ends with Mr. Cisco now. He's wearing a wire. He's in Dario Cueto's office. He's blowing his cover because he's just acting way too suspicious. Dario just right away picks up on the fact, you're wearing a wire? He's like, no, I'm not. He'll open your shirt. And of course, he opens his shirt. He's like, oh, they got me to do it. I'm sorry, boss. I wasn't going to rat you out. And so the guy was so nervous. I mean, you would think that somebody asked him to do a bullet drop. So Dario says, what do they want me for, huh? They want me for murder? And Cisco goes, no. And Dario says, in the most badass of ways, he goes, well, now they do, or I think he said they do now. And he bludgeons Cisco to death with the red bull statue on his desk, the same bull statue that his brother used to beat their mother to death. But it's okay, though, because she was an evil bitch. But that's according to Dario, anyway. So anyway, he sits down. He's got blood all over his hands now. We didn't actually see the murder. We just kind of assumed that Mr. Cisco is no longer with us. And Dario gets on the phone, and whoever it is that's on the other end of the line, he tells that person, it's time. Maybe he was referring to Vader time. And Dario is just really excited to see Vader wrestle Will Ospreay at the Rev Pro show next month. I'm guessing that's not the case. So that was Lucha Underground. Again, I enjoyed it more than I did part one. Part three, the finale, is 2 hours long. It's coming up this Wednesday. This is the last Lucha Underground episode, I think, until January, I believe. I expect it to be a great show. You've got Pentagon challenging for the title. You've got Rey Mysterio against Prince Puma, which is the dream match build as the main event. So, good stuff. I'm looking forward to it. Let's get to your mailbag questions. If you have questions to send to me, you may do so. Send to the Solomonster. That's thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Jake from South San Francisco. Why do you think Randy Orton's first world title run was cut so short? I will admit, looking back, I think his face turn was a bit rushed, but I loved it when he spat in Triple H's face. Felt like WWE was going to give Orton a good run with all the hype around Destiny and being the youngest champion, but he barely held it for a few weeks and never won it back. What are your thoughts on this? Triple H happened. That's what happened. That and Brock Lesnar left the company on bad terms, right? Just a lot of heat there, a lot of bad blood. So he left. And probably more so from WWE side because they felt betrayed. They spent so many years building this guy up and now he's leaving. It wasn't until it got into all the legal stuff later on that there was heat from both sides. But he left, And at the time, he had been billed as the youngest WWE champion in history, which technically was still true because you got the world title is different than the WWE title. But they had Orton win the world title, so then all of a sudden Orton became the youngest champion. They didn't have to call Brock Lesnar the youngest champion anymore. Now it's Randy Orton is the youngest champion, you know? Voila! So it was a combination of those two things. I don't want to say that's the only reason Orton got the belt. Maybe they would have... Because I don't think Benoit was keeping that belt beyond SummerSlam in 04 anyway. He was going to get the same run that Daniel Bryan was supposed to get in 2014 before he got hurt. Daniel Bryan was only going to hold the championship, supposedly, until SummerSlam, and it was going to be him getting thrashed by Brock Lesnar and not John Cena. But instead, Bryan got hurt, and they put John Cena in that spot instead. It was the same thing with Benoit. I don't think Benoit wasn't going to get thrashed the same way, but he was going to have a nice little six-month run. And unless he started to light the world on fire, which he didn't, he was going to drop it. But Triple H happened, and, you know, I guess the idea at that point was, well, we'll build up Randy Orton as a babyface for WrestleMania, and he'll get the WrestleMania win the following year. And, you know, it just didn't work that way. I mean, Randy Orton as a babyface just didn't work. Batista got hot. Organically got hot. People wanted to see Batista get the shot instead, and plans changed, and Randy Orton got the short end of the stick. And there were people who even came up with a word for it at the time, that Randy Orton got Ortoned. So that's what happened. Jake also has one more question for us. I was watching an old episode of Raw from 2004 when Eric Bischoff took the night off after getting his head shaved, and the entire Raw roster, led by Jericho, Benoit, and Maven... Oh my God, which one of these isn't like the rest? They all ganged up on Triple H. It was a satisfying moment to have the entire roster work as one against the evil overlord during the Reign of Terror. What I want to know is, why doesn't WWE ever have anything like this now against groups like the Authority? The closest thing to it that I can remember is when the entire Raw roster went on strike in 2011. Well, because everybody on that show is a giant pussy. That's why. Almost every single male member, I'm pretty sure, of that roster by now. Any male member of the roster that's any sort of mid-card or upper-card talent that means anything, has at one time or another been slapped by Stephanie McMahon. Not even Roman Reigns was spared. Now, Roman Reigns got slapped so hard, his eye began to swell. So even he got the shit smacked out of him. Stephanie McMahon has slapped or berated almost everybody of any note on that roster, and nobody ever does anything about it. The closest that anyone has come to embarrassing her recently, and I can go back even further and remember when Vicky Guerrero left, they actually let her push Stephanie into that pool of, I guess, chocolate or whatever the hell it was, and I was shocked they even did that. I figured they would embarrass Vicky on the way out. But that was also years ago. The most recent thing I could think of was on Monday night. You know, it wasn't even planned. It was the ring steps. She almost fell down. She was leaving the ring and she tripped and almost fell. And believe me, if she could have slapped those steps, she would have. But everybody on that show has been pussified. Simple as that. Mohammed from Bahrain. I was watching the amazing episode of WWE Bracketology, and it was a refreshing change. In the episode, Brian Kendrick talked about getting released from WWE. Why was he released? Pot. Supposedly, he failed one too many tests for marijuana. And they jobbed him out on the way out, and they fired him because they wanted to make an example out of somebody. Cody from South Carolina. My question is in regards to The Undertaker and the WrestleManias that he missed, 10 and 16. If he would have been healthy for these shows, who would you have liked to see him wrestle on these shows? Who would I have liked? Well, WrestleMania 10, let's see. The championship thing was pretty much already set because they did the whole Rumble double finish with Bret and Luger. And that was The Undertaker's last show. It was his last TV show. We hadn't seen him since the Rumble. He got put in the casket and his soul got taken up into the atmosphere or whatever. So, which sounds completely ridiculous. See, WWE was doing Final Deletion level over-the-top shit way before TNA was. So, you couldn't really work him into the championship thing. That would have kind of screwed things up. Honestly, when I think back to WrestleMania 10 and the matches on that show, obviously the ladder match I wouldn't touch. That worked out perfectly. I really would not want to see Undertaker in there against like Earthquake or something. But there was a mixed tag match at WrestleMania 10. It was Bam Bam Bigelow and Luna Vachon against Doink and Dink. A match that, believe me, I could do without. And I think by that point, the whole Doink Bam Bam thing had pretty much run its course. It had been going on since like late 93. To me, I would have taken Bam Bam Bigelow and I would have put him in there against The Undertaker. I don't remember ever seeing I'm almost positive they had either a TV match or a Coliseum video match because I remember seeing it, but there was never a big TV feud or a program between the two of them, and Bam Bam was a talented guy. You know, as far as big men goes, I mean, I think, and that was a different Undertaker. You got to remember, this was not the same Undertaker that wrestled Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania or any of that, but this was still the Undertaker who basically just choked people, and he was only beginning to incorporate some flashier moves and stuff into his matches. But I think Undertaker and Bam Bam Bigelow could have been a good match. You know, a hell of a lot better than Undertaker and King Kong Bundy at WrestleMania 11. That match was the shits. You know, or Giant Gonzalez. I think Bam Bam would have been a much better opponent. So I would say Bam Bam. And then as far as WrestleMania 16, I'd have let him go one-on-one with Steve Austin. I would have done Undertaker against Stone Cold. Now, of course, had they done that, there would be no streak because The Undertaker is not beating Stone Cold Steve Austin at WrestleMania. But I would have done Undertaker against Austin, and I would have saved Rock and Triple H as a singles match for the main event. That really should have been the main event of that WrestleMania. It should have been Rock and Triple H one-on-one with Rock winning the title. So I would have done that. At the very least, if you wanted to do the four-way, I would have had Triple H, Rock, Austin, you know, if you were healthy, and Undertaker. But I would much rather just you get two matches out of it and just do two singles matches. Marco from Seattle, I was listening to an episode of the Ross Report a few months ago where JR had Sting on as his guest. At one point, Sting claimed that his Crow gimmick had absolutely nothing to do with the movie The Crow. However, everything about that gimmick is very similar to the movie itself, such as the black and white face paint, the long hair, the trench coat, even an actual crow that Sting used a couple of times. Scott Hall, who was the one who gave him the idea for the gimmick, has even said that when he pitched it to Sting, he mentioned the crow. Do you have any idea as to why Sting would say that it had nothing to do with the movie when clearly it did? I didn't hear that episode of JR's podcast, but I don't know why Sting would say that. That really just doesn't make any sense to me. It absolutely was influenced by the crow. The first Crow movie came out, I think it was only a couple of years before Sting started doing it. There was a sequel. I think actually there was a sequel that came out. It was probably around the same time that he started doing the gimmick. So, you know, the movie was still relatively new. You know, we had the face paint, the trench coat, like you said, but also Scott Hall pitched it to him based off of the movie. He has said that. So I have no idea why Sting would say that. Now, of course, It was the crow. I mean, even now you look at the video games and stuff. What do they call it? Crow Sting, right? That's what they call it. Why do you think they refer to it that way? Why do you think people, when they talk about Sting, they talk Surfer Sting, they talk Crow Sting? I mean, that'd be like Sting saying the Joker character he played in TNA wasn't based off The Dark Knight or Heath Ledger. Or Razor Ramon wasn't a direct ripoff of Al Pacino in Scarface, which Scott Hall talks openly about on his new DVD, which is very good, by the way. You should all check it out. But yeah, I don't know why Sting would say that. Timothy from Texas, in your opinion, what is the best in-your-house pay-per-view ever? Some that come to mind are Bad Blood, Canadian Stampede, Revenge of the Taker, and Final Four. What do you think? The answer is Canadian Stampede. Canadian Stampede, July of 97 was the best in your house. Not only was it the best in your house they ever did, Canadian Stampede is one of the best pay-per-views that WWE ever did of any kind. Show was only 2 hours long. It had, I think, something like four matches on the entire show, and every single one of them was very good to great. One of their greatest pay-per-view main events ever was that 10-man tag. Even Undertaker and Vader, They had a pretty damn good match from what I can remember. I haven't seen it in a long time, but from what I can recall, it was a pretty damn good match, all things considered. So that would be it. Rob from London, which past wrestling event do you wish you were in attendance for and why? Does a crazy atmosphere matter for you the most, or is it the caliber of matches in terms of quality that overrides the former? It's both. I mean, the atmosphere, when you're there live, I think the atmosphere is more important, because the atmosphere and a hot crowd can save a show. If you have a match that's okay, a hot crowd can make an okay match really, really good. Or it can make a really, really good match legendary. So I would say that probably does matter more. Maybe if I'm watching on TV, I'm paying more attention to what's actually going on in the ring, and I have to listen to the announcers calling moves. It's just, it's different. But I've said this before. I've been to five WrestleManias now, and yet the one show I regret not being there for was the first ECW One Night Stand that WWE did. Webmaster Mike from SE Scoops, he was there, and I will forever be jealous of him for being there. I don't know that I've had as much fun before or after that pay-per-view aired, watching a pay-per-view, than I did for that one. And I say that as somebody who wasn't really a big ECW fan back when they originally ran. I was a casual ECW fan at best. You know, the ECW stuff is probably the stuff that I've watched the least of the older stuff I've gone back on the network and watched. I watched WWE stuff. I watched WCW stuff. ECW stuff, not so much. And I'm sure there's a ton of great stuff there. And one of these days, I'm gonna have to kind of find the time to get into it and watch stuff that I've probably never seen before. But I say that as somebody who wasn't like a big ECW fan. I watched that One Night Stand show, and I had a freaking blast. It was just so much fun. And the atmosphere, and, you know, Sandman coming out to his music, and all that stuff, obviously, that played a big part in it. Paul Heyman's promo. Plus, it was right there in New York. Like, I think back, I'm like, why the hell didn't I go to that show? Like, literally, I just hop on the train, take it to 34th Street, walk two blocks, and I'm there. I'm still kicking myself for not going. The Marietta Mauler, it's easy for me to say, Alexandru, has a buy or sell. Shawn Michaels' career from his return in 02 until his retirement, or Chris Jericho's career from 2008 to the present? They're both fantastic. I'm going to buy on HBK and sell on Chris Jericho. That guy, let me tell you something about this guy. Shawn Michaels, if you think about it, he had two amazing careers. The Shawn Michaels from 1988 or 89 or whenever he came in to 1998 was very different than the Shawn Michaels from 2002 to 2010. And a lot of things about his portrayal on TV and his character and his promos and things he used to say and things he wouldn't say now, like, there's a lot that was different about him. And yet both halves, if you just take the halves by themselves, are Hall of Fame worthy careers just on their own merits. Feuds, the matches, the everything. Now, Jericho's feud with Shawn Michaels is still his best, Jericho's best. Jericho had a great feud with Rey Mysterio, I think, after the Shawn stuff. I enjoyed the Jericho run with him and Big Show, which I didn't think I would, and they turned into a great tag team. And now the stupid idiot phase, I guess as people call it, I'm enjoying the hell out of what he's doing now. But Shawn Michaels, he came back, he had some incredible matches right out of the gate. With Triple H, he had incredible matches with Chris Jericho. He had really good matches with Randy Orton and John Cena and Kurt Angle. He retired Ric Flair. That was kind of a big deal that he did. And then, of course, the Undertaker stuff. I think that speaks for itself. So when you really lay it out, you look at what this guy did, the matches he had, the feuds he had, the WrestleMania matches, everything. When you really look at it, as great as Chris Jericho has been since 08, you can't even really compare the two. So Shawn wins all day long. Elliot from Houston, buy or sell on the more enjoyable over-the-top skit, the final deletion or Booker T. Stone Cold's brawl in the grocery store? Ah, they're both great. Why do I have to choose? I guess it's my segment, so that's why. The final deletion was way more over-the-top than the supermarket thing was. The fucking thing had drones and holograms and explosions and dilapidated boats and Matt Hardy riding a lawnmower. I'm going to buy on the final deletion. I'm going to buy in the Final Deletion. I'm going to sell the Supermarket Brawl. I've never seen anything like the Final Deletion before. It was just way out there. And funny. I laughed out loud a whole bunch of times. And I did too with the Stone Cold Booker T skit. But this one was a lot more elaborate than there were skits and other things that kind of led up to the match itself. Because if I had a guess, I would guess the length of the brawl that Booker T and Austin had was probably around the same length of the actual match that Matt and Jeff Hardy had. But then you throw in all the skits beforehand, and that kind of puts it over the top. Literally just over the top. But I love that Supermarket Brawl. That's one of my all-time favorite WWE segments. I mean, look, how can you not laugh at Stone Cold hitting Booker T in the head with a frozen pizza and singing, "That's Amore"? I mean, and that's only one of the things I remember from that skit. I remember the whole price check on Jackass thing. I remember, what was the other thing he did? He was, I forgot now, but there were like, even when that thing started and it shows Booker T's like opening boxes of cereal, "Oh, let me check and see if they're fresh." I'm like, I love that whole segment. I like stuff like that when WWE goes like on location and does like a giant brawl. I mean, what's not to like? But I gotta go with the Final Deletion here. I gotta give the nod to TNA on this one. I'm gonna buy on that. And this is a coincidence here. I swear this question came in, it was like a few hours after I got the last one. Actually, the last question I got like a few days ago, but this one came in yesterday. And it's not from Elliot, it's from Henny from England, and we'll end on this. Why did Booker T and Stone Cold never have a pay-per-view match after Booker cost Austin the title at Vengeance and a number one contenders match on Raw? They had a number of taped segments, including the Supermarket Brawl. There's a First Blood match on SmackDown and a tag match on Raw, but neither match had a feud-ending conclusion. Can you shed any light on this? Also, considering they both had meaningless matches at WrestleMania 18, do you think they could have had a blow-off match there? You know, that's a really good point that Henny makes. You know, the two of them had some really memorable segments together. And it wasn't just the Supermarket Brawl. I remember there was one at a bingo hall. There was one at a church. There might have been another one, but yet they never had a pay-per-view match. There was never a one-on-one singles match on a pay-per-view between Booker T and Stone Cold Steve Austin. And I honestly don't have a good answer for you. I don't have a great answer as to why. You know, maybe if I talk to Booker again, I'll ask him. I'm not even sure if he would know. I mean, by that point, they had taken Booker, and I mean, honestly, by that point, they had kind of turned him into a joke. You know, even Austin, when Austin dumped him out of the Royal Rumble match, he gave him a stunner, and Booker, you know, he kind of jumped out of the ring, and I don't know. I mean, it was just silly. I mean, here's a guy who was the final WCW champion and WCW United States champion. He had two belts when he came in. And here, by the end of not even a year later, really, or maybe a year later, he's reduced to wrestling Edge over a Japanese shampoo commercial. I mean, I'm just guessing they probably never saw him as being a worthy enough opponent for Austin, maybe in a singles match on a pay-per-view, which is ridiculous, because he would have been a perfectly fine opponent for him. But that would be my best guess. They just didn't see that as a high... They didn't see it as a high enough profile match, and there were other people at the time that they had planned for Austin, I guess, in their minds that were bigger than Booker. That would be my best guess. And I'll tell you something else. I mean, now that you mention all this was happening in late 01, early 02, so I would not be at all surprised if the NWO coming in had a lot to do with that. And I don't mean that politically, like they lobbied for Booker not to get the match. What I mean is Hogan, Hall, and Nash coming back, they had to know at some point, like a decent amount of time in advance, that these guys were coming back or that they were probably coming in. And if that's the case, those guys are the kind of guys that Austin should be in the ring with. You're bringing in Hulk Hogan. You know, again, it's a match they never did. They should have, but they didn't. I could see the NWO coming in, and they're already in their minds, they're creating plans for what they could do with Austin. And so Booker is like, at that point, the furthest thing from their mind because they got the NWO guys coming in. So I think timeline-wise, that probably makes sense. I mean, let's assume they knew before the Royal Rumble match, okay, in January, that these guys were coming in. And if they knew Austin was not going to be working with any of them at WrestleMania, yes, to answer your other question, they could have done Booker and Austin. They could have dragged it out longer. They could have done that at WrestleMania 18. Had the NWO guys not come in at all, you know what? Maybe they would have done that, because if Austin didn't wrestle Scott Hall, I don't know, who else would he have wrestled? You know, they were doing Undertaker and Ric Flair. They were doing Triple H's big comeback against Jericho, and you knew nobody was going to fuck up Triple H's comeback. Who else, if the NWO guys don't come in, well, I guess Rock. You could, yeah, I guess Rock. Could do another Rock-Austin match, I guess. But, yeah, if they wanted to, they could have done Austin and Booker as a blow-off at WrestleMania. Austin gets a big win. And at least Booker is not fighting over shampoo. Would have been a step up for him. So let's wrap up the mailbag here. We'll cinch this up and open it back up again next week. And if you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter. We just passed 18,000 followers, so thank you for that. @Solomonster is my handle. I live tweet during Raw. I'll be live tweeting during the draft on Tuesday night, so if you want to follow along, @Solomonster is a place to go. We have our poll up at the end of Raw every Monday night, thumbs up, thumbs down, so you can vote. And if you want to make a PayPal donation, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. I always say, like, I appreciate when people do that, and I really do. I mean that because if you're giving your money, if you're donating money, then that means I'm doing something right. And so that's a good feeling. So if you want to make a donation, you can do so at any time on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button to click on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you that nickname and shout-out if you want. Use our Audible link if you want to get a free audiobook and support the show. Buy a t-shirt in our store. And join us August 21st. SummerSlam Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern. We will be having a joint meetup, a Mania Crawl / Solomonster Sounds Off pre-SummerSlam meetup at the KBH Beer Hall, one of the best beer halls in all of Brooklyn. It's only a couple of blocks away from the Barclays Center. 2 p.m. that afternoon, pretty much from 2 to 6. If you think you can show up at any point, we'll be hanging out there. Hope to meet all of you. And we will be back with a draft wrap-up next weekend. There'll be a lot to talk about coming out of this draft. Plus, next weekend we'll have battleground predictions for the pay-per-view. It'll be another busy podcast. So that'll be next weekend, episode 451. Until then, thank you for 450 episodes of goodness that I have enjoyed doing. And as long as you guys enjoy listening, I'll keep doing it. So until next time, be well, stay safe, enjoy the draft, and we will see you right back here again for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
I'm just saying, I don't know, with New Day, you got three black guys out there. Why Francesca?
You want to call it Tyrone the Trombone?
Okay. That's racist.
Well, no, it's... I'm just
racist, no.
I'm not racist. Go to Hulk Hogan for that. That's not me.
You know, usually the people that go, I'm not racist, yeah, those are the racists.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.